Hi there, I'm Stefan T. Lawid, and welcome to Advanced STL Part 2, in which I will be looking at the STL's implementation again. Today we're going to be looking at various algorithms and how we use template metaprogramming in the STL to do fancy things like optimizations. So I talked about in the intro STL series in Part 10 the basics of template metaprogramming, things like type traits and enable if. And Sofiny, and how you can use those in your own programs. So today we're going to be looking at how the STL uses the sort of machinery in production code, which may be a little more advanced than anything you've done in your own code, although I promise it's not nearly as complicated as what Boost does in their implementation. They tend to do even crazier things than what the STL does. So what I was going to do today is show off something clever in C++ OX, just to give you a taste of one of the things that template metaprogramming can be used for. Here I've got the latest C++ OX working paper loaded, and if you look at the algorithms, this is available freely online. Let's look at the mutating algorithms. If you look under partitions, I'm going to zoom this somewhat so we can take a look at what's going on here. You'll notice that the C++ 03 algorithm partition, what it does is it'll take a range, say you've got a vector, and say you've got it filled with 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, something like this. And if you call partition with first, last, and give it a predicate like is this thing divisible by 3, then what the partition algorithm will do is return a range where all of the things that satisfy the predicate, usually I call these the good things, have been swapped, moved to the first part of the range, and everything that does not satisfy the predicate, or the bad elements as I call them, have been swapped to the end of the range. So it's essentially a permutation that puts the elements you care about before the elements that you don't want. It's not a full sort, so all you need is a predicate that says true or false for an individual element, rather than comparing two elements and saying which one goes before the next. The other thing about partition is that it's not stable. So within the elements that satisfy the predicate or don't, they can be unsorted order. So if my predicate was divisible by 3, I could get 3 here, and then the 6, and then the 9 like this, or any other order. It could change from run to run or anything. There's another algorithm, stable partition, that not only splits the elements like this, but also promises to preserve the relative order of identical elements. Now, if you look at the, actually I can show you for comparison, because I have the C++ 03 standard available. This one is not available freely online, but it's pretty cheap. And let me, come on, why is this not maximized? There we go. If we go to the algorithms node and again look at the mutating algorithms, in C++ 03, let me zoom in here, the partition algorithm was specified to take bidirectional iterators. Bidirectional iterator first and last, so you could call this on something like a std list, which is a doubly linked list, but you could not call it on something like a singly linked list, which conveniently was missing from C++ 03, but you could always define your own. So not only did partition require bidirectional iterators, but it also was specified to perform n over 2 swaps. That would be the worst case where all of the elements have to be swapped, essentially reversing them. And also talks about the number of applications of the predicate. Now let's switch to C++ OX and see what that specifies. In C++ OX, partitions interface has changed. Now it has a weaker requirement, meaning that it can be used in more situations. It can take, let me zoom in again, now it takes forward iterators. So you could actually call it on something like a forward list, which has been added to C++ OX. And it's got this fancy wording down here. There we go. It says, if the iterator given to partition is a bidirectional iterator, then it behaves like C++ 03 and does those n over 2 swaps. Otherwise, meaning that if it's only a forward iterator, at most last minus first swaps are done. So what this is specifying, this is the way that the standard tells implementers like Microsoft to do something without literally dictating what the implementation must be. Essentially, there are two different ways you could implement partition. One, if you've got bidirectional iterators or better, and like Vector has random access iterators, so those are very good. What you can do is put one iterator at the first, one iterator last, and test the predicate on each element, and if a bad element is found here, then we can swap it over there and gradually move the iterators to the center. So that's where the n over 2 comes from, because when the iterators meet, you've only performed at most n over 2 swaps. You can look at the implementation, debug through it if you want to see how that's done. So that was the old C++03 implementation. What C++OX is specifying here is that if you only have forward iterators, so let me erase this and show you what forward iterators look like. If you've got a forward list where you can only ever go forward and so forth, there's an end iterator there. It's still possible to implement a partition, but you can't use the same algorithm as for bidirectional iterators. Because if you're given a first iterator and a last iterator, the problem is that you can't do the trick of swap these elements potentially, then step them closer to the center, swap again, step closer to the center, because there's no way to go backwards. Instead, what the algorithm has to do is create two iterators, copies of the first iterator, and gradually step them forward like this, and swapping elements when they're determined to be out of order. And if you work out the math, this will result in a correct partition, but it can perform at most n swaps. So that's what is being specified here. And I was all ready to show it off because we've implemented this. Then I discovered that this is not implemented in VISA 10 RTM. It is in the current sources, which I don't have here. So this fascinating new algorithm, you'll have to wait just a bit to receive. So instead, I'm going to show you an algorithm that is in VISA 10 RTM that does the same sort of thing, essentially switching on the power of an iterator to do something more special. So suppose I've got a vector here, and I'm writing a generic algorithm. Imagine that I've got some arbitrary iterator, and I know that I need an element that is 5 beyond. For whatever reason, my algorithm needs I plus 5, essentially. So for a random access iterator, I can write I plus 5. For anything weaker than a random access iterator, so bidirectional or forward or things like that, I can get an iterator 5 beyond, but I have to say plus plus I 5 times and then go dereference it to get the element. So I could write, you know, two different algorithms, one called, you know, foobar underscore random and another one called foobar underscore forward, that the random access algorithm would feel free to say things like I plus 5, I minus 5, whereas a forward iterator only algorithm would have to say plus plus all the time. Fortunately, there are helper algorithms in the STL, particularly in the iterator header. So of course I'm always careful to include all the headers that I need. I'll just minimize those. So here I've got a vector. I'm filling it up with integers from 0 to 9 inclusive. And again, this is highly contrived. I just want to debug into the algorithm and show you what's going on. If I have an iterator like C begin here, I can call advance on, and IntelliSense is showing me here. I increased the font size. Thanks for the people who sent me tips. So this should be visible even if you're watching one of the lower res videos. And I can advance it by 5 and then print out whatever that is. So if I execute this on the console, my vector contains the numbers 0 through 9 as promised. The iterator initially pointed to 0. I advanced it by 5, and I got 5 printed out, which happens to be the element there. So now let's debug into that and see what it does. Now, let me show you what this looks like in the standard. This would be in the iterator node. I like browsing the standard particularly the standard library specification, because it's conveniently sorted by the things I care about, iterators, containers, things like that. So it's under iterator primitives, iterator operations. Here's the algorithm I'm calling advance. It takes a reference to an input iterator, and that means input iterator or better, vector iterators are certainly better, and a distance, and it says increments or decrements for negative n, the iterator by n. So that's what advance does. Let's debug into that. Okay, so I'm going to step into advance here, and now we're in the X utility header. As I mentioned in part one, the X prefix means that it's internal to our implementation, not to be included directly by users. We'll define sort of centralized helper algorithms in this header. So here's the public algorithm advance with a pretty name that takes an input iterator and the offset. And then it calls our helper algorithm underscore advance with, it's just passing down where off, and then this thing intercat where. So what is that? And I did not name intercat as much as I do like cats. Here cat means category. Let's step into that. So intercat is also an X utility. And here you can see that it takes an iterator, and what does it do? It returns, it gets iterator traits for that iterator. This is std iterator traits, and it finds the iterator category type def and returns an object of that type. So what this is doing is we're not actually interested in this object. It's an empty struct. It exists only for its type. So the fact that it's actually returning something is not really of interest. This will all be optimized out. So let's step out of this, Shift F11, and then step back into underscore advance. Underscore advance has been overloaded. So this is one of the things where you have to do a little bit of C++ in your head. We can step into with the debugger what function is called. So function A calls function B. But the compiler is doing things like template argument deduction and overload resolution statically at compile time. So if functions are overloaded, well, the debugger will show you what's eventually called, but it won't tell you why that function was chosen by the compiler. So you have to do that work in your head. Fortunately, here it's quite easy. So we had seen, if I open the call stack, we had called this intercat helper function, which returned a struct, either random access iterator tag in the case of a vector iterator, or if I called this with a forward iterator, it would be forward iterator tag, things like that. So let's see what we called. We called an overload of underscore advance that takes random access iterator tag. So this is a parameter, but we don't actually care what its value is, so we didn't give it a name. This is just like if I wrote an algorithm, void foo, that took int n, and then another int that I just wanted to drop on the floor and do nothing with, I can just say int and not bother to give it name. That's exactly what I've done here, we've done here. We're taking a random an object of type random access iterator tag, but then just doing nothing with it. Its only purpose is for overload resolution. So that's the trick that's going on here. Basically, if we detect a random access iterator tag, we can increment our iterator with plus equal. This is constant time. Random access iterators are awesome. But if we're given a weaker iterator, like bidirectional or forward, then we've got these other overloads of underscore advance. They've got the same arguments on the first two, the same parameter types on the first two parameters, but the third one is different. So if we get a bidirectional iterator, then this overload will be chosen, and it will either increment or decrement the iterator for a negative offset. And if we're given the weakest iterator, well, second weakest iterator of all, forward iterator, or the weakest iterator, input iterator, we can only go forward, so we'll pre-increment the iterator n times. So this allows you to write things like generic algorithm that can say, okay, I'll accept random access iterators. In that case, I'll be really efficient. I'll increment this iterator in constant time. If you give me anything weaker, I can still perform my algorithm, but I'll have to do more work. I'll have to increment the iterator separately n times. And this is all chosen by the compiler statically at compile time. We're not doing any runtime switching. There's no virtual table calls, no double indirections, nothing like that. So this is what template mattered programming is. It sounds scary, but it's really just getting the compiler to do some work for you so that you can do interesting things at runtime. So this is what template metaprogramming looks like, the very basics in the STL. Now I'm going to show off some of the cool things we do in the algorithm header. Specifically, instead of dispatching on the powers of iterators like std partition does in C++ OX and std advance and std next do in the iterator header, we can also do things where the user gives us iterators to arbitrary things, and we have to perform our generic algorithm on them. But sometimes we can detect, oh, if the iterators are pointers, and if the element type is something basic like int or unsigned char, then hey, instead of looping over every element and doing something, we can just call a faster function, maybe from the C standard library, like memcomp or memcopy or memmove, and do something faster than the core language usually allows us to do. So let's take a look at that. I think my first victim will be std equal, because that one's pretty convenient. So instead of vector int, I want a vector of unsigned char, because I know we activate the optimization for this. And I'll print it out. I don't really care about that. I want a copy of this, so I can just compare. Vector unsigned char. I could just say auto here. C2 is a copy of C. And then I'm going to ask, are the two ranges equal from... Now, if I just wanted to compare the whole vector and see if it's equal to C2, I would just say C equals C2, and that returns a bool. This will compare their sizes, and if the sizes are different, then obviously the vectors can't be equal. A vector of 10 elements is never equal to a vector of 100 elements. But the std and the std equal algorithm can compare subranges. So let's do that. Suppose I just want to look at the first 5 elements of these vectors. Obviously, I need to have tested before to make sure that there actually are 5 elements, otherwise I've got a bug. So let's do std equal from C begin to C begin plus 5, only the first 5 elements, and then my second range is C2 begin. C2 needs to have at least 5 elements, which it does. And this will return a bool, I hope. Let's look at that IntelliSense again. I could just look at the standard. Yes, it does return bool. Excellent. And I want to print that out. And because I like to be fancy, it's switching through overloads. I'm going to ask cout to print bools in alphanumeric form, like this. For that, I'm always careful to include the right headers. That comes from the IOS header. And there we go. So now, let me close this output window. I would certainly expect to see true being printed out because these vectors are copies of each other. So let's compile and run. And what do I get? Oh, let me step past the equal. And yes, I get the first 5 elements of these two identical vectors are equal. Excellent. How did std equal do this work? Well, in general, what it has to do is say, compare the first 2 elements at the two given iterators, step them forward 1, compare those elements, and so forth. And if any of those comparisons return false, then the whole algorithm needs to return false. However, when we detect things like vectors of unsigned chars, we can do something more efficient. So let's take a look at that. Let's step into equal. And again, this is one of those things that is not required by the standard. An implementation is certainly free to always do the naive thing that always works. But as a quality of implementation issue, implementers like Microsoft and Dinkumware are free to add optimizations that preserve correctness but make your program execute faster. And we basically love doing this every chance that we can get. So let's step into equal. I'm going to need to step in and out of all these begin functions, which I'm not interested in for the moment. And here we go, equal. So again, the public function that takes 3 input iterators. We've got some debugs checks here in debug mode. I'll probably have to cover those in a future part. I'm not interested in those today. Let's skip over those. And now we're going to call, go through a bunch of helper functions. Again, this is for our iterator debugging machinery. I want to skip over all of this stuff. So, oh, I skipped too far. Sorry. Let me restart. And equal, go in. I could just set a breakpoint on the destination, but it's probably faster just to do this. And yes, the destination is checked. Let's call this helper function. Okay. Oh, we only have the optimization. Okay, this is surprising. This is not the algorithm that I expected because I'm getting the arbitrary algorithm. So here's the general implementation of std::equal that, like I said, iterates through the two ranges and compares, okay, are these elements the same, are these elements the same, and so forth. But we've got a couple overloads below. I guess I can sort of do some debugging and figure out why we weren't calling these. If we detect that we're comparing pointers to care, pointers to signed care, or pointers to unsigned care, then we can simply call the C standard library function memcomp, which basically compares chunks of bytes for equality. And we know that care, signed care, and unsigned care are just bytes. The reason why this can be faster is the C standard library function memcomp exists precisely because, given chunks of bytes, processors can often do something faster to see if these two byte ranges are equal. These often have dedicated assembly implementations that can be faster than anything you could write in the core language, even after the optimizer has gone through with it. So by calling memcomp, we can be faster than this general loop here. So I expected that this here would be called, and it was not. Let me see why. So I'm going to do some compile time debugging. I may actually have to write a to-do to myself to fix this in VC11. This often happens. We're getting something correct here, but we could be faster. So let's take a look at what's going on. I need to look at the watch window. Let me pull that up. And I want to see here, actually, the locals window will be good. I want to look at the types. Again, like I mentioned, the compiler won't tell me why it's choosing what it chose, but I can figure it out by doing a little investigative work. So I care about the types of these iterators because these equal functions have been overloaded. So the compiler is telling me that after I went through all of those helper functions for our iterator debugging stuff, we have the first one and last one iterators, which was my first range, the vector unsigned care, they've been unwrapped. This is our iterator debugging machinery again, from vector unsigned care iterator to pointer to unsigned care. So that's good. The problem, the reason why that our faster implementations aren't being called, is that the second range, which is also a vector unsigned care, is still a std vector iterator. So I want to see what that type is. Of course, I mean, my font console is 20, so the type is ginormous. Let's see. This tooltip is saying that it's a vector iterator to unsigned care. This should have been unwrapped. It was not. So let's take a look at the call stack. So we were asking, this is the public member function equal. Let me pin this again. We called our helper function unchecked, gave it a couple iterators, and we needed to switch on whether the destination was checked to emit a warning when you're just comparing with a raw pointer. And then that called this overload here equal 1. Aha, here's the problem. So we had carefully unwrapped the first and first one and last one iterator. So given vector iterator, this will return our internal unsigned care star. We passed the second range down. And then after determining that the destination was properly checked here, we didn't go and unwrap first two. Whereas if we turn off in release mode, that's when iterator debug level is set to 0, we'll uncheck all three iterators. So here I can determine what's going on. In release mode, we do have the optimization. Because we'll uncheck all three iterators, and for ranges of care, signed care, or unsigned care, we'll do the fast thing and call memcomp. But in debug mode, we are not unwrapping that second range, and so we're always calling the generic algorithm. So it's okay. It's not a critical bug, performance bug, because it's only in debug mode, but still it would be nice to call memcomp. So I'll definitely have to write a to-do to myself to see if we can do something about that in VC11. So mystery solved. That's one thing, one little sort of taste of what I get to do all day. Now there's another issue here that I was already aware of that I have a to-do to address in VC11. No promises, but I'll see what I can do. Imagine that instead of working on vectors of unsigned care, that you've got vectors of int. So if you've got a vector int, say a couple of them, okay, each int is 4 bytes on our platform, and you ask, okay, are subranges of these vectors equal to each other? And by the way, as an implementation detail, if we simply ask if v1 equal v2, internally this just checks their sizes and then calls std equal on the subranges. So this optimization here to do something smart for care, signed care, and unsigned care is also used when comparing vectors for equality with double equal. Now, what about for vectors of ints? Now, the generic algorithm will of course work. We can compare this first int for equality against the second. But what do we know about the built-in type int? It's that representation equality for it, if we look at the 4 bytes that comprise an int, that's identical to value equality for it. So if these 4 bytes are equal to these 4 bytes, then this whole int is equal to this whole int. So what that means is that this optimization that we've got here is too specific. It's only being activated for care, signed care, and unsigned care, but we could generalize it to all integer types. Short int, long, both signed and unsigned variants, because on our 2's complement architecture, which is true for x86 and x64, for both signed and unsigned integers, value equality and representation equality are the same. So my to-do is to extend this optimization to all of the integral types, not just care and signed care and unsigned care. But we need to be careful. We don't want to go too far. So what if I'm comparing not vectors of ints, but vectors of doubles? Well, vectors of doubles, those are 8 bytes each. So first disclaimer, comparing doubles for equality is almost always a bad idea because floating point math cannot represent real numbers with infinite precision. This is a sort of gotcha that's universal to the programming field. But there's nothing stopping you from calling std equal on doubles, and the STL has to do the correct thing. It has to behave as if you're comparing these doubles for equality with, you know, v0 equal v1, regardless of whether this is a good idea or not to write. We have to return the correct answer. The problem is that for doubles and floating point in general, representation equality is not the same as value equality, because with floating point, you can have both positive 0 and negative 0, which is impossible for 2's complement signed integers and totally impossible for unsigned integers. Positive 0 and negative 0, if you look at what standards like IEEE say, they compare equal, but they have different representations. So we can't simply call memcomp on these, because that'll get the wrong answer if negative zeros are involved. And then there are not a number floating points which behave even more strangely. I'm not a floating point expert. All I know is that NANDs are something to be feared, treated with respect. But certainly the negative zero issue is enough for us not to call it memcomp. So we can't extend this to all arithmetic types, only to integers and possibly enumerations, but I may or may not want to do that. I would have to think carefully about it. So that's what std equal does. We could also think about performing this optimization for other types like pointers, because pointers, they are represented as byte sequences, and value equality is the same as representation equality for them. So we could possibly activate this optimization for pointers, and depending on the type traits available to us, possibly even for user-defined types, as long as they're trivial enough. But I certainly don't want to spec out that as I'm talking. When we look at this, we'll figure out exactly how far we want to extend that optimization. So that's a look into some of the fancy things that we do in std::equal. Now let's look at sort of the most high-powered optimization we have in this area, and that's copy. So let's take vector of, actually now I want to show you vector int. Let me close these headers. So let's go back to my vector int. And now, suppose that I have another vector int v, and go like this, 0i less than 10 plus si. I want to push back the squares of each integers in here. I could use an ESTA algorithm for this, but I just want to type real fast. Like that. And now I'm going to call std::copy. And it takes first and last, so I want to copy v begin to v end. Oh, I can't type. And my destination will be c, this other vector here, begin. I've made sure that my destination of size 10 is large enough to hold my source, all of the source integers, which are also 10 of them. And then let's go through c and print that out. So here I would expect to see 0 through 9 printed out, and then the squares of 0 through 9. Let's stop running, compile, and execute, and see what this returns. And success. C is initially 0 through 9, and then we overwrite that range with my vector v, which contained the squares of the integers. So now the destination C has the squares 0 through 81. Excellent. Let's take a look at what happened within std::copy. This helper algorithm is used throughout the STL in many places, so its performance is extremely important. Let's debug into this. So let's step into std::copy. I need to bounce in and out of the begin and end helper functions. And okay, so std::copy takes an input iterator first and last, this is the source, and then an output iterator destination. Again, we've got that iterator debugging machinery. That I'm going to skip over. We call underscore copy impl. Here's a little aside that may interest you. Back in part one of the advanced series, I had mentioned that underscore capital names are reserved for exclusive use of the compiler and standard library. And our usual tradition is an algorithm like equal will call a helper algorithm with underscore capital version of its name, so underscore capital equal. Why aren't we calling underscore capital copy here? Well, the answer is we were in VC10, and then we discovered a collision. ATL's headers had decided that they could use underscore capital copy for their own uses, and even worse, that was publicly documented. So the STL, in the presence of certain using directives, would collide with ATL, because it had used names traditionally reserved for the standard library. So we changed the STL to call underscore copy impl to avoid that, because obviously both the STL and ATL headers have to play nice together. So that's why we're doing that there. Let's step into copy impl and see what this does. Step, 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 go in, bounce in and out of is checked and unchecked. And copy impl, okay, when the destination is checked, then let's look at the two categories, again, bounce in and out. I'm trying to get to the core algorithm. We'll check the destination range. This is if you're doing a buffer overrun. Our iterator debugging machinery can detect that in certain cases. And here we're correctly unwrapping the dest. This is the thing that was not being done in std::equal. Let's step into this and copy impl. Okay, here's where the magic begins. So after going through a bunch of helper functions, which the compiler, the inliner, will be nice enough to optimize out. We call copy impl with our first, last, and dest, and let's take a look at what those are. Let's look at my locals. Here we've unwrapped everything, and they are all just built-in int stars. We call this helper function putter cat. This returns the category of pointers, And its arguments are the first iterator and then the destination iterator. Here we don't actually care about their values. We care about their types. Let's take a look at what this putter cat function does. Here we go. So, yes. Let me minimize this again. Okay. So we're in the xutility header again. This is our centralized header where a lot of magic happens. And putter cat is a function. Let me show you where all of them are. Okay. So putter cat is templated on two elms, and there should be a general implementation above. I want to show you that one. Yes. Okay. So here is one of the overloads of putter cat. So for arbitrary iterators, these could be user-defined iterators or iterators from the standard library, like a list iterator or even a regex iterator, things like that. For arbitrary iterators, what we do is we return a type non-scalar putter iterator tag. This basically says these iterators are class types. They're certainly not things like pointing to contiguous storage of built-ins, so you need to use the most general algorithm possible for that. But then we have these overloads of putter cat. So we've got some helper structs here. There are several layers of template metaprogramming going on that are doing a lot of advanced things. Okay, so here's the overload of putter cat. So this has been overloaded on two pointers. For a pointer to LM1 and pointer to LM2, we know that we're working with raw pointers, so we're either actually looking at built-in C arrays or std arrays that have been unwrapped or std vectors that have been unwrapped. When we're doing things like copying from, I've got vector double here, I was working with vector of int. Okay. So when we're copying from contiguous ranges of a built-in type like int, we can simply call memmove to blast the bytes from the source to the destination rather than looping through all of the ints and assigning them one by one. So what we need to do is we need to restrict this optimization because we certainly can't call memmove all of the time. So if we're given arbitrary iterators like forward list iterators or std dec iterators, that non-scalar putter iterator tag overload will be chosen, saying you need to use the general implementation that loops through and assigns one by one. But when we're given raw pointers, we may be able to activate the optimization. That's what this overload here is for. But we have to be careful about the types involved. What if I was assigning a vector int to a vector of long? Sort of running out of whiteboard here. Copying from vector int to vector long is totally cool. If my int here contains the number 1729, then std copy will simply assign it over here, and I'll get a longer 8-byte long that has the value 1729. So std copy is totally valid to call between vectors of different types. However, when we're faced with this, we cannot simply call memcopy because each 4-byte int needs to be given to an 8-byte long. Memcopy would simply blast the bytes over, and we would end up stomping over only half of the vector in the destination. So we need to make sure that not only are the iterators raw pointers after unwrapping, but that the elements are identical. And also that they are built-ins like int and unsigned char, things like that. Because if I've got something like a vector of std string, that's a user-defined type. In this case, the user is the standard library. And we need to actually call copy constructors. So there's a whole lot of things that have to go right. The stars have to align before this optimization can be activated. Let's look at what putter cat helper does. We give it LM1 and LM2. So we've relied on overloading somewhat to detect whether these things are putters, pointers. Now we're going to use a partial specialization of a class template to do more of the template metaprogramming. So let's look at putter cat helper immediately above. So when we're given completely different elements, things like int and long, we need to deactivate our optimization. So the general template, puttercat helper, says non-scalar putter iterator tag, use the generic algorithm. If the types are identical, so here we've got a partial specialization, so when they're the same type, then we can activate it as long as the type is something built-in-ish, like int, so int to int, or long to long, or unsigned char to unsigned char. We know the types are identical, so let's look at that type. We're going to use the TR1 type trait, C++ OX type trait, is scalar. So is scalar returns true for things like ints, unsigned longs, and also things like pointers. If we've got a vector of raw pointers, non-owning raw pointers, hopefully, it's okay to memcopy those pointers from the source to the destination, because again, pointers are just bits. So if they're scalar, then we'll use our fast implementation, otherwise the general implementation. However, we can do something a little trickier. This is one of the places where we go out of our way to implement something very efficient. What if my source is a vector of int star, pointing to ints that I don't have to delete, and my destination is a, so this is source, this is dest, is a vector of const int star. So previously I said when the element types are different, we usually can't activate this optimization. But if we're taking int star and assigning it to constant star, so we're just applying constness, these things have the same representation. It's okay to just blast these from source destination with memmove. So if the source is an anything star and the destination is a const anything star, then usually we would have said that, whoa, we can't activate the optimization. But in this special case, we can. I've got a to-do to look at extending this even further, because in certain other cases, the types could be different, but we can still know that their representations are identical. For example, copying between int and unsigned int, that converts values, but it doesn't actually convert the representation. So in the future, we may extend this even further to activate the optimization in more cases without damaging correctness. And then we return, we've seen how this works, a tag of that type. So let's take a look at my call stack. Oh, I'm already in puttercat. Let's step out. I call copy impl. Here we go. Here's the advanced implementation. So copy impl, when all that puttercat machinery determines non-scalar putter iterator tag, this says copy the source range to the destination range for arbitrary iterators. Here we do the completely general, works every time thing, looping through the iterators and assigning the source value to the destination value. But when all that puttercat machinery has told us that it's okay to do the fast thing, then we can simply call memmove. And this will copy a chunk of bytes from the source to the destination faster, hopefully, than this generic loop using that dedicated assembly implementation. So I'm almost out of time, but let me mention a couple more things here before I let you go. Another one of my to-dos is to make this even faster. It turns out, I believe I noticed this just through a code review, we are doing something slightly too slow here. If you look at the assembly that this compiles to, and in the STL, that's one of the few places where micro-optimization is a valid thing to do. Here we're being given things that we know are raw pointers, and we subtract the last iterator minus the first iterator to get the number of elements involved. This does pointer arithmetic. And then we multiply the number of elements involved by the size of that element. Again, doing a multiplication. And then we'll take the destination pointer and add a number of elements to it. It turns out that we're doing pointer arithmetic here, multiplying and dividing by the size of the element. But think about what's happening here. Because of all of the puttercat machinery, we know that we're blasting a chunk of bytes from the source to the destination. We don't need to do all of this work. We can simply say, okay, pretend that dest is, through a bunch of casts, a pointer to unsigned char or a void star. I forget what memmove takes. And same for first and same for count. There's no reason to do any of this pointer arithmetic. So in future versions, we may replace this stuff with casts that save a few cycles, and that could actually make programs more efficient if they're calling std copy in a very tight loop, so they're doing potentially millions of copies per second, in that case, the number of instructions we're executing here could matter. The other thing, and this actually puzzled me for a long time when I first saw this, this is std copy, but we're calling the C standard library function memmove. Why aren't we calling the C standard library memcopy here? There's a reason for that. I call this the memmove conspiracy. So let's take a look at the C standard, which I conveniently have. In the library, the memcopy stuff, I believe it's in stdlib.h. And where is it? String.h. Yes, here we go. It's in string.h. So take a look at the memcopy function. Let me zoom this in and scroll down. Memcopy. Memcopy is famous for prohibiting copying between ranges that overlap. Essentially, the assembly instructions that it emits cannot handle overlapping ranges. This allows it to be faster for completely non-overlapping ranges. Whereas the memmove function from the C standard library can handle arbitrarily overlapping ranges. That's the difference between memmove and memcopy. Now let's take a look at the C++ standard. May as well look at OX, although C++ 03 is identical. Algorithms mutating copy. And if you look at the way the copy is specified, let me zoom in here a bit. There we go. So copy from first to last result. It says that you've got this range first and last. And it says that the result iterator shall not be in the range first last. So if you're trying to copy, say you've got a single vector, and you're trying to copy this chunk of elements to the destination here, where the result iterator is between first and last, this is prohibited by std copy. You cannot do this. But the reverse is not true. The way that std copy is specified, it is okay to call std copy with, say, I've got a big old vector here. Okay. It's okay if I give it result here, S-U-L-T, so that the source range overlaps the destination range, but backwards, essentially taking these elements and saying, put this element here, put this element here, and so forth. The naive implementation handles this correctly. Std copy must work in this case, but memcopy does not. That's why we call the general memmove. One of my to-dos is that we're very careful to call memmove all the time, but in some cases, we do know that the ranges can't overlap. For example, when a vector reallocates, its new memory block can't overlap the old memory block. We still call memmove there, but it would technically be possible, I believe, for us to call memcopy and unlock perhaps a little bit of extra performance, something that we'll look at in future versions. So that's all the time I have for today. Today we saw how the STL uses template metaprogramming to combine the generality of the STL, working with arbitrary iterators, pointing to arbitrary types, and yet emitting extremely efficient code, even going down all the way to the bare metal and saying, I need to call memmove or memcomp to compare or copy these ranges of bytes as fast as possible. That's the great thing about the STL, that although it allows you to work at a very high level of abstraction, it's not putting extra layers of machinery between you and the machine that you're executing on. See you next time.